but we want to minimize any impact to existing counties. And the Department of Revenue, Mr. Phillips, has been very helpful in terms of addressing some concerns associated with the legislation, specifically the definition of what we are trying to address and, with respect to turbines, the administration of the tax, and even suggesting that we look further at some modification to a type of tax structure that electric co-ops.
It's for you.
It is?
Right.
That electric co-ops are currently subjected to. That's it. Again, Mr. Chair, our amendments are not prepared, but I want to make it very, very clear that we are trying to structure something that will provide an incentive for the development of wind power in the state of Oregon, while at the same time avoiding any detrimental impacts to counties currently maintaining facilities in their locations. That is our underlying goal.
Okay. We'll come back with questions, Mr. Powell. I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Powell, representing Lifeline Renewable Energy. Richard has kind of outlined the problem, and the overarching problem is the property tax rate. And Pat can talk more about other options and why we believe this is the best long-term option for wind power in Oregon. The amendments that are in drafting right now will create a date in which all new facilities thereafter will be subject to the production tax. Current facilities would be phased to that production tax for a 5 to 8 year period of gradually moving toward the production tax, and once that period is over, they would be subject to the production tax. We hope what happens during that period of time is a build-out of existing facilities. Some are permitted for many more megawatts than they've actually built out, and we're hoping that that occurs. We're hoping that this project can get online, and so overall the revenue to governments in Oregon can actually increase in time as opposed to decrease. But without addressing the underlying problem, it simply will create a time period. If it's a 10-year tax break or a 5-year tax break, it'll create a period of time where the underlying problem continues to haunt the ability to get financing for these projects, that sort of thing. As you might imagine, if you go to a lender or to an investor and ask them to loan you millions of dollars, they will require you to show a performance. And if the tax rate, as high as in this case 20% of your revenues, would make it very, very difficult to obtain that kind of long-term financing. So we believe that going to a production tax makes sense over time, and we hope that the amendments will create a phase-in that will allow that to happen without radical changes in the tax revenues of counties.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Pills.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Right?
Yes, Pilts.
Okay.
My name's Patricia Pilts. I'm the Vice President of Development for Lifeline Renewable Energy. And I'd like to start with what an explanation of what the underlying problem is that we're trying to solve so that we're all on the same page. The property tax rules in Oregon, as they're currently administered, disadvantage wind development in two important ways. The first is that wind power facilities are, relative to, say, a natural gas cogen facility, cost twice as much to construct. It's the nature of the turbines are much more expensive. So while a rule of thumb, and it's a good rule of thumb, says that it costs $1,000 a kilowatt to build a wind power plant, it costs $500 a kilowatt to build a gas fire plant. Now, if your property taxes are based on your cost to construct, our property taxes on a wind power plant are going to be twice as high gas generating plant, but we're selling our power into the same market at market rate. And so that's a huge disadvantage. Now, wind obviously traditionally makes up for the huge cost to construct by very low operating costs. We don't have to buy any fuel. And so during that time, we can pay off the debt incurred during the construction period. So it balances out, unless there's some kind of a ringer thrown in there, which is an exorbitant property tax that came about because it was based on the cost to construct. Our theory is that the value of the property is based on its ability to generate revenue, and in that case, very closely mirrors the value of a fossil fuel plant. And so we think that for competitive purposes and for equity, we ought to be treated somewhat the same. That's the first problem. The second, and that's just a problem of equity. The second problem is a problem with the absolute dollar amount, that if you take a $15 tax rate in Morrow County, for example, and apply it to a plant that costs $100 million to build. Now, that's just the cost of developing that 100-megawatt plant. You produce a very high property tax number, $1.5 million, say, by the time you do all the math, $1.5 million per year, that's completely out of proportion to what it takes to finance and operate that plant. It's because the absolute dollar, 17% of your expected revenue, if you look at the numbers, we would expect that plant, property taxes aside, to cost $1.7 million a year to operate, and the property taxes, you know, would be between $1.2 and $1.5 million. It's the number, the stark number itself, is completely out of proportion to the enterprise that we're working on. So we sought a solution that didn't involve asking for a tax break in enterprise zone, for example, because it appeared to us that that would continue the theory that there was something somehow economically crippled about wind, that wind power itself was more expensive, that it was still a boutique form of energy that needed special pampering. We don't believe that. We want the opportunity to sell our power on the open market at market rates. And it's that simple, and so we'd like to fix the underlying problem and therefore haven't sought any special exemptions or an enterprise zone, but an attempt to deal with what disadvantages wind in rural Oregon and what would be a very wind-friendly model. What would put Oregon at the forefront of wind-friendly states, and chose a production tax model where the revenue is steady. It doesn't depreciate. The amount of money that the county knows it's going to get at the beginning is the amount that it's going to get forever. It could increase in a good year, wind year. It could decrease in a bad wind year, but those levels of increase and decrease is a very narrow band. It's less than 5%. You know what your facility is going to produce because that's how you get financed anyway. No depreciation and a dependable, steady revenue stream for the counties, and that's what we're looking for.
Okay. Questions? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a question, but I think she should be a teacher.
Well, you got the picture?
I got the picture. Okay. Very clearly.
Is that here?
Yes.
Representative Berger. Do I have a question?
Yeah, this is really interesting. I'm fascinated by the conundrum faced here, and you're right, you've done a wonderful job of explaining it. Some states have a longer history in wind power. Wyoming comes to mind. What do they do about this issue, or is it just a completely different tax structure and not a problem?
I can ask you a question?
You go through the chair, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Whatever he said.
Don't worry.
There are, yes, other states have longer experience. The state with the longest experience is California, for example, and the county in California with the longest experience is Riverside County. where they view a turbine or a wind farm as just a collection of equipment. And the equipment is assessed at cost, and the county's property tax rate is applied. The property tax rates we're dealing with here are a little higher. That's one of the problems we're dealing with. But they have then, they depreciate that equipment as an incentive very quickly over 5 years, so that while you might start out with a turbine on a per turbine basis with a property tax that might be $14,000, at the end of 5 years it's $7,000. It got to its economic floor, and it stays like that for the balance of the project. So the math, because these things are on long-term power contracts and they're on long-term financing, the math works out. That's one solution. A whole lot of other states, Kansas comes to mind, who want to be wind-friendly, just exempt the wind facilities from property taxes altogether, which is something we're looking for a solution in the particular part of Oregon where we're working. And we understand what our county's needs are, we understand what our landowners' needs are, and that's not something that's interesting. Minnesota, which is probably has the most progressive tax in this case, has a tax that's a production tax credit and a production tax on instead of property taxes, and that's where we stole the idea.
Other questions? How many turbines go into a facility like the one you're talking about? What's a $100 million facility look like?
This could be a long speech, and but it's 61, say, in this example. It depends on the turbine size that's selected for the facility. These are utility-scale facilities, and so you'd be looking at big turbines, 60, 100 megawatts. If you have a turbine that's a 1.65 megawatt turbine, that the answer to that is 61. If it was a 1 megawatt turbine, it would take 100 of them. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, you'd be looking in the facilities that would be coming online in the future, you'd be looking at 1.5 megawatt turbines and upward. Twos are going to be very common in big, where you have a lot of land for big projects going forward. So you take the rated size of the turbine, a 1.5 megawatt turbine. In our case, it's probably going to be a 1.65 megawatt turbine divided into the 100 megawatt size, and you get 61.
Yeah. Other questions? Yeah, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Is there a place that we can go to relatively quickly get a sort of an overview of the economics of this kind of operation? I mean, I do much better with seeing things on paper or on the computer. I wonder if there's a URL I could go to or something like that that might have all that information.
There are, Mr. Chairman. I've seen some sites. I don't know the addresses, but we could certainly, are we allowed to provide all this information afterwards?
Yeah.
I mean, we have spreadsheets, too.
Yeah.
We'd love to give you a spreadsheet that showed you, in general, what the economics of one of these facilities were. It's fairly standard. They all look kind of the same.
Do you have other facilities in operation here in Oregon now?
Lifeline doesn't have any. Lifeline was created to build this facility in Morrow County and to develop this property owner's property for wind development. But the wind people who make up Lifeline have other facilities whose, as I said, the spreadsheets that we use and what a typical wind farm looks like, they're very standard. The numbers can be certainly verified in any number of URL sites on the web.
Okay. Representative?
Thank you. Just a follow-up. I was just wondering if you have any of these other, if they're cited in other states, what they do. The track record is there.
Track record for?
The company's track record.
Lifeline. Yes. Lifeline Renewable Energy, Mr. Chairman, was founded to build this facility, these facilities, to develop this land in eastern Oregon. The people, I do believe we have a handout already prepared to give to the committee which names who it is that are working, who the people are, who the major contractors, who the major players are, wind power people who are working on our facilities in Oregon, and I believe that would address the issue. All of Lifeline is made up, think of it as kind of a collective of wind power people, people who have been in the industry in many cases since its very founding for more than 20 years. I don't think that there's anyone on the list who hasn't had 20 years experience in the wind industry and a long list of projects which had been developed. I'm probably the least experienced of the lot with only 12 years.
How long does it take to put in a facility like this, and I guess put it in to production? And when it goes into production, does it take a period of years to ramp up, or once you go online, are you online and you're producing? Okay, so it's not like a cherry orchard then that it takes however many years it takes for cherry trees to grow up, and when they start to produce a little bit, and then more and more as the trees mature, the crop matures. But this goes in, and once you get it up, you turn it on, and you're in business. Is that it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. 6 months is a rule of thumb from breaking down, from breaking ground, assuming you're pushing everybody and you don't run into any unexpected problems. You can have a 100-megawatt facility constructed and in operation in 6 months. And, in fact, as the turbines are strung together, you can be start producing minimal power, start testing out the system toward the end of that 6 months. So, yes, the answer is that at the end of your six, call it 10 if there was weather in the way, at the end of that, you're producing at capacity. You turn on the switch, the wind blows, and you're in business.
So the issue here isn't, with regard to the tax, isn't so much the issue of tax being imposed before you get any production out of the turbines. We're just talking here about rate of tax versus rate of return. Is that what this really boils down to?
Very much so. It happens that at the existing tax rates, for example, in a rural county, which are designed to be applied to rural land, if you throw something in there that's assessed at cost, that cost $100 million to build, the absolute dollar amount that you're expected to pay into that county is prohibitive. Okay. And that's one argument. The one I like the best, though, frankly, is the long-term disadvantage you have as compared to a combined cycle gas-fired plant, which costs half as much to build. And so the property tax is based on that. And they get this break forever, where it ought to be equitable.
Yeah. Representative Barnhart?
This is probably a bad question for me to ask because of where I'm from, but another difference between the wind power plant and the gas-fired power plant is the gas-fired power plant has to buy gas, and you don't buy wind. Can you give us some sense as to how that fact plays into the operating costs and the relationship we're talking about?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
That's a good question. So the gas plant isn't paying as much in tax, but they are paying...
They're paying for fuel.
That's right, yeah.
And whereas the wind power system doesn't pay for fuel.
So there are other costs to take into account when you're measuring one against the other.
That's exactly right.
Now, excuse me, there's one other difference, and that is you can run the gas-fired plant all the time. Your plant can only run when there's fuel, that is wind, available.
It's the case that the reason that wind can be competitive with virtually everything now except for legacy hydro is that our high cost to construct is offset by very low operating costs because we don't have to buy any fuel. So it's the case that a gas plant's cost to operate will be variable with the price of fuel, but we would assume that's fair. They chose to build a gas plant, and so they have to pay for fuel. We pay for fuel in some ways. There are obviously rents to landowners involved. But as compared to buying natural gas, that's not a lot of money. But every cent, essentially, for the first 10, 12 years of the time that you're financing that construction, that $100 million worth of construction, really goes to pay the bank. I mean, there's not a lot of wiggle room. With power prices the way they are now, between 2.7 cents and 3 cents, depending on if you got lucky with the green tags or what was going on, you know, that the debt, paying the debt every year is going to be a number like $10 million. You actually don't even throw off that much in revenue, and you have to finance it using the federal production tax credits and a number of other things. It's just wind power is competitive, but it's a model that's very close to the bone.
Thank you.
We've got some more testimony. Other questions?
Right. Mr. Chairman, just the handout that you received is kind of laid out in four parts. That, as Pat said, the first two pages kind of outlines who is involved in the project and Lifeline Renewable Energy. Should know that then the fourth page in is kind of a shaded document that talks about Shepherd's Ridge Wind Farm. This is, in fact, the name of the project. The application for the land use conditional use permit has been submitted, and I believe
it was approved. Granted on the 27th.
So it is that far along. This document kind of outlines for you where it is, the fact that we're talking about an annual energy output to produce energy for about 60,000 homes, the environmental benefit, and also talks about the acres that will be used. And while there are a large number of acres involved, fewer than 18 of those acres will bear a permanent footprint of turbines. The rest of it will continue in agricultural production. The following page simply outlines the problem as Pat has given it to you. Then there are five pages demonstrating what some other states have done. The one I do not have in here is Minnesota, which Pat said has gone to a production tax. But I put these in here to show you that indeed other states have created incentives for wind power development. And as you'll see by just looking at these examples, these are very stark, in many cases, almost complete property tax exemptions. So with that, Mr. Chairman, we thank you for your time. And
I'm sorry, Mazin has a question.
If I want to try to understand this correctly, you have high starting costs and then try to equalize the high starting costs by lower taxes. When you get to the point when it's producing just on the same premise as a gas plant, does the tax rate you envision goes back to the same amount, or...
Mr. Chairman, may I answer?
Sure.
No, the projects are 20 years. That's the underlying power purchase agreement is generally 20 years long. The low costs to operate last forever. And in all places, but the instance where we're looking now, where we have an extraordinarily high rural tax rate applied to an industrial facility, for example, the tax rates are generally the same, and everybody coexists happily. The first 10 years, 12 years of the facility's life, everything's used to pay off the debt. And it's in the second 10 years that the equity investors get any of their money back. So essentially the whole package is modeled on 20 years, at which point after that you negotiate new land agreements, you negotiate new power agreements, you can start all over again, and the world is new. But these are not exorbitant returns. You know, the rate on financing a facility this sort at the moment might be 6.5%. The equity target for the investors in these facilities right now is a 9% internal rate of return. So, you know, we're not looking at 50%, 25%. There isn't anybody out there getting rich off what's going on. It's a package, an economic whole, that generally you can move through the system as long as you don't have one number out of whack. Because there's just, if you want to sell wind power in the electric power market, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, where your underlying legacy hydro keeps your rates relatively low, then you can't have a big number come up and jump at you. You could, in one instance, if you were in a really dynamite wind regime, a real howler, where you might be getting a 40% capacity factor on your plant, there's extra money for people. And if I were a county where the wind were blowing that hard, I'd want some of that extra money. But those aren't the capacity factors that we're looking at in eastern Oregon.
Representative Bridges?
What changes would the amendments make to the bill?
Well, as I understand, the amendments phase in this your operating tax for existing facilities. Is that it, to minimize or at least delay the impact on existing facilities so that counties that have existing facilities don't see a cliff where they drop off from their property tax to this production tax? Is that it?
Exactly, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And 20 years for the energy agreement, what's the lifespan of a turbine? Or do we know?
Well, we have many, Mr. Chairman, we have many that are still running. For example, in some of the earliest wind parks that were built in Tehachapi, California, for example, and those were kind of tinny. They're not anywhere nearly the modern industrial, you know, behemoths that they are today. It's the lifespan of a turbine, a modern turbine, with proper maintenance, and it's in everybody's advantage that there be proper maintenance, can be indefinite. The blades change out, the turbines change out, the towers change out. If you have a problem with one, you can move it, you can replace it. It's also the case that as turbine technology changes, there's a new, faster way, better gear ratios. It's economical, if you already have a developed site, to even change out these turbines. That's exactly right. So it's modular in that sense, and at a reasonable wind site, the lifespan of a wind farm is considered to be indefinite.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see. Next, I've got Paul Chalmers and Judge Pryor. Why don't you come on up, too? Let's take a vote. We didn't let you come up last week. I guess we'll let you this time. We were under the gun last time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here with Judge Laura Pryor, Gillum County, and past president of AOC, and Paul Chalmers, Umatilla County Assessor, who's past president of the State Assessors Association. They both are from counties that have successful wind production as we speak under the current taxation system. I'm just going to make one comment before they begin. AOC, looking at the original bill and the concept in the original bill, opposes it fairly emphatically. So with that, Lori.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Laura Pryor. I'm the county judge in Gillum County. And I also am a landowner that has some towers on our farm. I want to get that out of the way because I understand that there's been some discussion about whether or not that's a conflict of interest for me to testify here. So I think I would leave that up to you to decide whether
you can go right ahead.
Thank you. During the time that this was before our county court, I wasn't even in the room. I wanted to be sure that there wasn't any conflict of interest. But I have had the experience of having it happen in my county and as a landowner. I happen to personally believe in renewable energies, and I think that we should do what we can to make sure that they're profitable. SeaWest is a company that put the 84 towers in our county, and they have an enterprise zone. We gave them that. And they did the project in two pieces because they wanted to wait for the federal tax credit to be approved and passed. They put that project online. Any project has a year. They put these test towers up to see, to measure the wind flow and to see how much they're going to get to see whether it's profitable or not. I haven't heard one of them in Oregon that's been ever been told anything other than you're marginal. And yet somehow they go ahead and they do it anyway. There are some things that I think that we should all think about when we consider this. This type of energy is incentivized for the federal government and through Oregon through the enterprise zones. Morrow County does have an enterprise zone. Lifeline did come to my county. They talked to my county planner a couple of times. There are so many of these companies out there then I ran a Dun & Bradstreet on to try to find out something about that. And the lady is correct. They were put together to do just this project. We couldn't find out any information at all. In fact, if you have something now, you have more than we ever had. And that could be because they decided to do the project in Morrow County. I talked to Judge Thomas, talked to some of us, and Morrow County was told the same thing by this company. We don't need debt appraisal. We're never going to need it. He didn't know, nor did his court know, his county commissioners know, about this bill until after they had passed the conditional use process in their county. Some of the questions I'd like to know, and some of them you've already asked, is what size are the projects that you already are running and where are they? Who's buying the power? Well, last we were told there's not anything left on the BPA grid, so I don't know. Maybe I don't have the information because this is not my business. When a tower project is put up on your property, and most of these are in rural Oregon, so most of them are going to be in agriculture or natural resource use somehow. If you are in agriculture and if you are involved with FSA, Federal Farm Services Corporation, or any of the federal farm programs, the land that you put the towers on comes out of production. Now, when you get the document and you sign it as a landowner, you know what the footprint of these tower projects is going to be on your land. And you know how much of that land you're going to have to go into the federal office and take out of the farm program. What happens is, in construction, and it's inherent in this process, I truly believe that no one sets out to do this. I think it's just inherent in the construction process. What happens is you end up losing a lot more land because they have to put roads in, and they say they're going to take a 30-foot right-of-way. Perhaps that's what they tell you. Well, you end up with so much rock out in the field that you've lost 60, 80 feet, and you can never get it back. So even though you can only take out so much of the footprint from the farm program, you lose far more than that because they can never get all that rock back out of your fields. It's just gone. You can never use that again. That's another issue. I'm going to ask you to be very careful in considering this request. I absolutely oppose it. And the reason I oppose it is because of the things that I've said, but also because in rural Oregon, if you lose any of your taxing ability, if the property tax is not applied to this, then it's not, it's just gone. And there's no transparency. There's very little transparency with these companies as to, for the county or the landowners, to what they're, how much power they're providing. And they can stop them or start them at will, depending upon how their tax flow benefits them in different ways. So we have asked repeatedly, why aren't those towers running? There's plenty of wind blowing. And you don't get an answer. The answer is always different. So you would have to believe, if you listen to them, that you would have to believe that either these towers have a lot of internal problem with their construction or their communications lines and whatever makes them go, the telecommunications stuff, or they're being manipulated to the benefit of the company. And if they have more than one site, they can shut some down, they can run others. And I suppose if I was in that business, I'd be doing the same thing. But it's not anything you're going to be able to count on. I can almost guarantee you that. And with that, I ask you, please consider this carefully, because these are rural communities that will lose this property tax base. My county taxed itself $46 a thousand before Major 5. We've already lost. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Judge Pryor? If not, let's pick up Mr. Chalmers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Paul Chalmers. I'm the Director of Assessment and Taxation for Umatilla County. We have the privilege in Umatilla County of being a dual-fuel county. We have the largest wind project currently online in Umatilla County, and we also have the largest production of cogeneration in our county. So I'd like to speak to that, if I may, and that opportunity comes. I'm here representing Umatilla County and 60-plus taxing authorities in Umatilla County. Umatilla County has probably the largest, if not the largest, number of taxing authorities in Umatilla County in the whole state. Our board has passed a resolution. The Board of Commissioners have passed a resolution adamantly against this House Bill 3610, and because they recognize the potential loss for our county functions in Umatilla County. We passed that by resolution. I've been in contact with one of the largest industry producers of wind power in our county, in our state. Those folks are against this House Bill 3610, and they have their own concerns accordingly. Is it okay to stand up, sir?
Yes. Well, let's see. We want to be able to make sure you stay.
Okay.
Can you move that over closer to you?
That'd be fine. Or I can just, it's color-coded, so
sure.
It's got a good
okay.
visual if you folks are clear with that. What this map represents is the wind projects currently online and proposed in Umatilla County. The testimony I heard earlier is that wind power is distracted from Oregon because of the disincentives. We have over $110 million of current project online in Umatilla County. The green section that you see there is a proposed project in Umatilla County. It's moving forward. A company called Toman is actively pursuing. You can see Van Sickle, which is the pink area, which was the first project in Umatilla County, 38 towers. Currently, State Line Project, which is the light lime green. And State Line Number 2, which is the blue area, is now being finished as we speak. I mean, it will be online rather soon. I'm not sure why the disincentive. No one has talked to the federal tax credit up to this point in time. I honestly don't understand the whole provision of that federal tax credit, but my understanding, it's being renewed, being reviewed, and no view in sight of it being eliminated. I'm concerned about this transition to a production tax. If it reduces a local property tax, it actually shifts the burden to the state, and it shifts the burden to the state in the form of education funding. Whatever is produced locally is offset by the equalization for education. And indeed, in the Helix School District, where a large number of this project is, I haven't quantified this yet, but I'd venture to say that this project may be paying for all of Helix's education. If that value or tax is reduced or diminished, the state's going to have to pick up that liability in the equalization process. I'd like to refer, Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, your question regards to gas power and the assumptions there. We have two large gas power production facilities, cogen facilities in our county. Each of them have received enterprise zones for 5 years. They were not able to receive commercial facilities under construction, but they are exempted for 5 years at the point in time that they go online for the following 5 years. As far as the gas tax or gas costs associated with that in regards to production, they only go online when they're needed or can. One facility has opted to be on the open market. The other facility has opted and has a long-term contract and has Pacific Corp and is selling that power as a as-needed basis. And indeed, gas power production is valued on the cost approach for its first years. Once they receive an income stream, they will be based and valued based on an income stream through the utility section of the Department of Revenue.
Well, that's what I was going to ask about these. Or if you've got income coming in from them the minute they go up and they turn the switch, why are they being taxed on a cost approach? Why don't they go to an income?
They do after that transition point in time,
they do.
Mr. Chairman. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And we've had that discussion, actually, as early as last week with regards to Hermiston Power Project. With some costs associated with that.
Well, okay, so I think we heard that it takes maybe 6 months, 10 months to get these things up to the point that you turn the switch and you're actually producing power and receiving income. Are you saying that at that point in time, as early as that, you You switch these over to an income assessment basis?
Mr. Chairman, on the gas turbines, it'll take up to a year and a half, maybe 2 years to have them.
The wind turbines.
Wind turbines would be, actually, we're looking at a cost approach on ours, from what I understand from the Department of Revenue. And though their projected cost of $1 million per tower, because of the size of our generators, we're actually looking at about $660,000 per tower that we're putting on the roll.
Well, okay, so then do they stay at cost, or do you do tax wind turbines on income?
They would transition to an income approach.
Okay, over what period of time then? Over the
As soon as there's an income stream that they can quantify that income.
Okay, that's for the wind turbines.
Correct.
Okay.
Well,
yeah, Representative Barnhart.
Well, and a follow-up to that then, what's the rate? I mean, how do you calculate that tax based on the production?
Representative Barnhart, are you talking about as far as the tax rate, or are you talking about the capitalization rate of the income?
This is all about, it's not a production tax. They capitalize the value of the asset based on the income.
Correct.
And then that value is applied against the property tax rate.
Correct.
So the income approach is just a different method of valuing the asset.
Correct.
They're not really taxing income from the production.
Thank you. That's very helpful, because this is all new to me, and I appreciate that. So I think what you're telling me, and tell me if this is right, is that when you do that, when you do the adjustment that the chairman just described, you end up with a valuation of about two-thirds of the actual construction costs.
That's what it appears at this time, Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart. And from that regards, I would also be I would like to mention the fact that we have a very strong working relationship with the power producers in our county. The comments from the representative of last week, who was up here visiting, made that comment. They really enjoy working at the local county level, and this transition to a production tax would change that relationship to a state level. They have very vested interest in our county and in the back doors, if you will, of the state, and making sure things are happening as far as donations along those lines, community service along those lines, civic projects, and those types of things. That's real important to these folks.
And to keep track, I guess there's something else that's you mentioned that I want to make sure I understand too, just as part of this. The appraisal for on an income basis is done by the Department of Revenue, not by the counties. Is that what you're talking about when you switch the relationship from the counties to the state? Then you're out of the business, basically, when you go to the income-based appraisal method?
Mr. Chairman, all three approaches are actually done at the state level.
Okay.
Yes, sir. And we receive a finished number, if you will, from the state that we apply to the tax roll in the specific.
Okay.
I'm rather curious also about the Morrow County $15 rate per thousand. That seems excessively high in light of the fact if it's in a rural setting outside the city limits. For example, in our county where these wind turbines are placed, is a rate between $10 and $12 per thousand.
All right, Representative Barnhart.
Well, again, I'm back to the numbers, because I'm very concrete in thinking about this stuff, if I may. What sort of, do we have any idea what the comparison would be between the 3610 tax and the current tax that you're getting in terms of ratios or relationship between those, what that would be?
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Pryor.
I'll take a crack at that. I ask our assessor to tell us what the difference would be, and I didn't bring it with me, but I have the memo from her. She worked up the numbers working with the state, and after C-West runs through the enterprise zone and comes online for their property tax, it would be about $250,000 a year to the county. If this bill goes through, it would be $50,000.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, the numbers I had received also substantiate that fact. It's proprietary information as far as production, though that information is sometimes generated through the enterprise zone. My understanding from Gillum County is an 80% reduction in value. Sherman County would be looking at a 60% reduction of value, and for clarity purposes, that value times a rate generates tax. So it's big numbers for rural Oregon.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you
much.
Yeah, come on up, Brad Higbee. John Phillips, if you have anything you want to add to enlighten us about the appraisal process here, that'd be helpful too, I think.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Come on up, John, just in case there's questions. Yeah.
Thank you for not asking me to enlighten you on the appraisal process.
I wouldn't dream of it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Higbee on behalf of the Renewable Northwest Project, appearing here today to express some conflicted neutrality on House Bill 3610. The Renewable Northwest Project is a nonprofit organization based in Portland that promotes the development of renewable energy in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. It's made up of environmental and consumer organizations as well as renewable energy developers, like wind developers. We learned about this legislation when we saw it printed, and we began discussions with the proponents as well as trying to poll our members in terms of what would work. Again, just to reiterate what some folks have said, we feel it's very important to do everything we can to promote the development of renewable energy for a variety of reasons. First of all, it's important to build the base of energy supply here in the Northwest. It's also important to create a diversity of energy supply so that we don't have all of our power eggs, as it were, in one basket. I say that advisedly the day after Easter, I know. So to the extent that if we're relying entirely or to a great extent on hydropower and there's a drought, and or natural gas and there's a radical increase in the price or a problem in one of the transmission pipelines, it could be a bit of a problem for us in the region. Therefore, the more diversity we could build, the better. In addition to that, there are significant environmental benefits that's important to a lot of folks, not just those in Eugene, but also those in Umatilla County, where a concentration of fossil fuel power development and the emissions that they produce are a significant factor for the folks there as well as throughout the state of Oregon. Another basic advantage is jobs. It takes people to actually construct these projects, to operate and maintain them, and that's an important factor for a lot of these struggling rural communities around the state. And speaking of which, one of the chief advantages and why a number of farmers and ranchers are very interested in promoting the development of wind energy in particular in Oregon is the lease payments that were mentioned previously. Farmers and ranchers, in exchange for permission to plant a wind turbine on their property, and on average it takes up about a quarter of an acre of their production, can receive between excuse me, I get all choked up when I talk about economic benefits, apparently. Can actually produce lease payments to the farmers and ranchers between $2,500 and $5,000 per year per turbine. That's a significant revenue shot in the arm for a lot of the folks in, again, some struggling areas of the state, which leads finally to a significant benefit to the local governments in the regional areas where these projects are developed, hence the irony and trepidation in trying to talk about this particular proposal. The property tax revenue generated by wind projects is another significant shot in the arm to the rural communities because it means quite a bit to the local tax bases. That's been important to folks in Sherman County, Gillum County, Umatilla, as you've heard. Very briefly, Mr. Chair, after that not-so-brief introductory commentary, again, we're interested that folks are willing to talk about doing things to promote renewable energy. Our folks have been a little tentative about the idea of creating a brand new tax to do that. They're very uncomfortable with the notion of doing something that flies in the face of working cooperatively with local governments to get this done. We would much prefer to see some sort of a mechanism in place that would provide a local option, essentially leave to the discretion of the county whether or not there should be, and to what extent, any sort of financial development, financial incentive to the development of these projects. Why would it be necessary to even consider such a thing? As you've heard before, these are hugely expensive to construct. A fossil fuel natural gas plant is incredibly cheap by comparison to build. The fluctuating cost of buying the natural gas over a period of time to operate the plant is, as you had suggested, Representative Barnhart, one of the significant factors in the cost, but the major impediment of getting a lot of these wind projects going is the cost. It's about $1 million per megawatt to get the projects going, and unless you can get something other than a marginal wind site, it's going to be fairly tricky to get some of these to pencil out. So therefore, it's worthwhile in our view to explore everything we can in terms of incentives to get these going not just for the environmental benefits, but for all the other local economic development benefits that I'd mentioned before. I'd be more than happy, Mr. Chair, to work with anybody to try to craft some sort of an alternative to creating a brand new production tax. And perhaps there's some way to try to make that work over time, as a matter of fact. But at this point, we're not willing to enthusiastically embrace that approach. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Higby? All right, stay there just in case we come up with them while there's room at the table, while we hear from John Phillips.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. After this bill was heard in the Senate, we did some analysis because we would be the entity that's actually monitoring and the taxes, production tax. And we had some concerns about how appraisal is done from central assessment, and I've detailed those, and I won't go into detail on those details. But we've provided these to all the people that we're aware that are interested in this plan, and it would be helpful to have a little more clarity, and I'm assuming that the amendments will help flesh out some of the issues we've raised. There have been a lot of questions about appraisal about centrally assessed property, cost approach, income approach, and I am not the expert on that, but I would certainly be able to provide someone that could do that if the committee wants to pursue that line of questioning.
All right. Any questions for John? One question I had, maybe you know, maybe Deborah, you do. What other types of tax incentives are there available for projects like this? I mean, income tax, what other kind of tax incentives are there at federal and state level? You don't know offhand? Okay.
Mr.
Yeah, you mentioned enterprise zone being one for
a strategic investment.
Strategic investment.
Mr. Chair, if I might just expand, the production tax credit, the federal production tax credit, is something that had been mentioned previously, and that's to provide a credit to developers from the federal production tax. It is generally approved for a set period of time, a matter of year, 2 years, 3 years. It expires fairly frequently, and the legislature is always under a great deal of pressure in Washington, D.C. to try to extend it again. I believe the debate is current. So that the question of extending the federal production tax credit is being debated as we speak.
Is that a production tax credit to wind power specifically, or is it across the board on other types of power generation as well?
Mr. Chair, I believe it's renewable energy, but primarily focused on wind. I could stand to be corrected from people behind me on that.
Green power, okay.
Thank you, it worked.
Okay. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else want to ask anybody in the room any questions before we close the hearing on this? Representative Barnard?
Well, Mr. Chair, this is simply an observation at this point, and I apologize for being late, and this comment may even be out of line because of that. But,
okay, I'm going to grab the gavel then. Go ahead.
But
thanks for the warning.
When we're looking at a big change like this in the tax system and the tax structure, I would hope that we would have a great deal more information about the economics of the business plans that are involved, the kinds of competitive issues, and how this tax fits into the overall taxing system than we have now. I think the information we have is simply inadequate to consider this measure at the current time. I would like a lot more information. I really appreciate the judge's comment on the lack of, on the opacity. That wasn't the word she used, but on the
transparency.
She used the transparency, the lack of transparency of the kinds of issues we're dealing with. And I would think that we ought to insist on a great deal more information before we would consider a bill like this. Simply,
well,
my opinion.
Thank you. This bill is on loan to us from the Rules Committee, specifically to look at the tax and revenue implications of this, so maybe we can get some more of that information.
And unfortunately, we haven't gotten it.
Well, this is our first shot. Their first shot, so
yeah.
We'll take a look, maybe in conjunction with the amendments, with some more of that information, and give us another look at it. Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3610. Thank you, everybody, for their very interesting testimony on that bill. And let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2299. I should have asked if our economic development people wanted to talk about it all on 3610, but you don't. Okay. Mike Burton and John Pasconi. I'm sorry, Representative Hunt, you're here. Are you here on this bill? Come on up. Do we have those out? Okay. Madison, would you please give us the lowdown on this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2299 is a bill that was primarily introduced and shepherded through the process for the Department of Economic Development, Economic and Community Development.
Mm-hmm.
And it, for the most part, it concentrates on five major issues that it tries to reorganize and introduce also new concepts within. Those concepts to talk about the strategic investment program, how to use that in a program that brought a number of investments in the 90s to Oregon and to the metropolitan area in general, and tailor it more to be able to use it in rural investments and make it accessible in that sense. The second main subject that the bill deals with is rearrangement of the enterprise zones, how those 47 zones that exist now with the Indian Reservation and federal enterprise zones, how to put them into a different sense of reorganization. And out of that, there is also a short-term exemption of enterprise zones, having what construction and process is, how do we put these into a more manageable way. And then finally, the long-term enterprise zone exemption also is put into a more coherent format and try to rearrange that statutes. And here I think there probably will be a discussion between the differences that would be created between the strategic investment program as it's newly proposed in the House bill and the long-term rural enterprise zone exemption. Finally, it touches on the electronic commerce, the e-commerce zones as known, and how those are working.
Okay, and we have Dash A5 and Dash A6 amendments. Do those come to us from the department?
Mr. Chair, the Dash A5 and A6, I don't believe they come from the department. They are an attempt to define certain things within the bill. The Dash 5 defines what a rural area means.
Representative Hunt is here on the Dash 5. I just got my sheet on that. Okay. Dash 4, do we know where these came from?
The Dash
6. Dash 6, rather.
Dash 6.
Yes. Oh, they're yours. They're yours.
Me.
Okay. All right. You're Mr. Pascone? Okay. Well, we'll get to you then. Good. Now we know who the players are. Let's start with the... Representative Hunt, do you want to go with yours first? Do you want to wait until we've talked about the bill? I want to...
Whatever your pleasure, Mr. Chair.
It might be helpful to the committee if we heard kind of the overview of the bill, and that'd give us a sense where your amendments fit in if you've got time. Okay.
All right. Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us to testify before you today. A couple of you have heard this bill at length. It's been before the House Committee on Trade and Economic Development. And I'm prepared to repeat that presentation and cover this bill at length. But we may not have to. The introduction was pretty good from staff. Essentially, the department proposed a bill to address a technical corrections bill on our business tax incentives. There were three elements of that. One of those was the Small Cities Incentive Program, which you heard last week through Senator Butler's amendments, and our amendments to that program have been moved to 2298 and are no longer in 2299. So this bill addresses, as staff reported, strategic investment program and enterprise zone programs.
Okay.
It's a consequence, really, of direction that the department received subsequent to the 99 session, when a number of our constituents complained to the legislature that the bill is
the law is unwieldy, that over time the enterprise zone statute's been amended piecemeal as adjustments and corrections were proposed, and it's to the point where to read the statute as it's written is nearly impossible. Therefore, to use the statute in this tax incentive program is problematic. So the department has proposed essentially to reorder the enterprise zone statute so that it follows a chronological order from the creation of a zone to the termination of a zone. This big, nasty bill before you is mostly removing pieces and putting them back in someplace else. So unless it's the pleasure of the committee, it's not my intention to walk through those details. There are, however, some policy changes that are incorporated in the bill, and I'd like to touch on those.
Focus on those.
All right. I want to thank, first of all, I want to comment, again, related to the history of this bill. The department made a proposal in the last session, proposed, in addition to reordering, eliminating some criteria or standards that were felt to be unnecessarily complicating for a fairly marginal return. Heard back in spades from our constituents, our customers, cities, counties, assessors, everybody else, that these changes were in truth substantive. Because of that, and because of an issue related to labor on construction of these projects, the department withdrew the bill in the last session and spent most of the interim working with those customers. I mentioned cities, counties, assessors, the Special Districts Association, the Department of Revenue, union representation, business development representation, and business tax attorneys. And we believe that the proposal before you, while it does now include some substantive changes, is a good bill. We've got a whole bunch of people sitting behind me here.
Not really?
Oh, they left? No. The ones that matter are still there. The ones that matter are still there, keeping their eye on me, making sure that we don't change directions in mid-course here. But we believe that there's essentially consensus on this bill, that it makes some important corrections, and it's something that you should pass, that you should move forward.
Okay.
The first major component is the strategic investment program. Before I get to that, I'm going to talk a little bit about the lengthy handout I gave you, just to let you know what's in it. I'm going to walk through this first piece before the first green tab, because that summarizes the policy changes, and I want to touch on them. The next piece is a description, and it starts on page 3, of the strategic investment program. unless you want me to, I'm not planning on spending much time on that. Then, starting on page 5, a description of the Enterprise Zone program. Most of the material in here is on the tab starting with page 11, which is a report of the activities within Enterprise Zones in Oregon over the most recent tax year, and some summary information that follows up with that. Starting on page 31 is a section-by-section analysis of what the bill does, and depending on the pleasure of the committee, we can spend no time on this or as much time as you'd like walking through the various pieces. Certainly, if you're interested in the department's intent for the bill, if you move through this, you can get a good understanding of what the department's trying to do with the bill and our customers. And then the final piece is a description of e-commerce zones, which are a creation of the last legislature. There was a piece in the bill that left a blank for the legislature to fill in on the number of new zones. The Trade and Economic Development Committee decided that we should give the 4 zones we've got a chance to play out for a while and see where that goes, and is not proposing a change in the number of zones at this.
Tell you what, just for playing on our time this morning, since this is a big packet and we're hearing this for the first time, why don't we just have you address the substantive aspects of this bill in your testimony, and then, Paul, let's reschedule this for a work session on Wednesday. That'll give members time to look at the packet, and if they have any questions about the technical pieces, we can take that up in work session, but plan on doing that on Wednesday. Sound okay?
Chair Federley, I appreciate that opportunity.
Push this thing through, give you a chance to touch on the substantive, but not take unnecessary time on just the procedural aspects of the bill. We can deal with those outside the meeting, and then if we have any questions, bring you back in on Wednesday for questions before we move the thing.
All right, Chair Shatterly, I appreciate that. I would, I have to beg off on my presence on Wednesday. I'd be available to members of the committee in the afternoon today or Tuesday, but Wednesday I'm presenting before our subcommittee on Ways and Means and have to be.
Okay, that's fine.
But we can have staff here on Wednesday to answer specifically technical questions.
Then what I would ask maybe for the committee is if you have questions to be addressed in committee, let Mr. Burton know or Paul Warner, and then we'll make sure we get staff, somebody competent to answer that on Wednesday. Otherwise, we'll assume that everyone's okay on the technical pieces. Okay?
All right. Chair Chatterley and members of the committee, I'm going to talk briefly about the Strategic Investment Program. This program was created when Intel took a look at expanding in Oregon and considered the large investment that they might need to make and balanced that against what was then a tax structure heavily biased toward property taxes, more so than now because it was before the passage of Measure 47 and about the time of the passage of Measure 5. This program is targeted toward investments, very large investments. There's no benefit until the investment gets substantially over $100 million. I mentioned the description of the program on page 3. On page 4 is actually a list of the exemptions that have happened over time. There are a total of 6.
So with a large wind turbine?
Well, we were kibitzing in the back of the room while you were hearing that question. There is a proposal in the Strategic Investment Program that would create a rural exemption for strategic investment, scale the size of a large investment more to rural areas, that we think would be a very good fit for these kinds of investments. And it is a locally negotiated incentive. Okay. So very much gets to the issue you heard from the counties and the assessors. We think it's a good fix. This is a good bill. It's got lots of good stuff in it. All right. The Strategic Investment Program, as I said, is targeted toward very large projects and allows for an up to 15-year exemption on property taxes. It's not a total exemption. The first $100 million is taxed. And then beyond that, there is a community service fee that's charged to cover for incremental service demands of various providers. That service fee is capped at $2 million. So I mentioned that we've proposed to tailor that for rural areas. In the rural areas, the bill would propose that cap be instead $25 million, or one quarter, so the community service fee be proportionally $500,000, and with the cities, counties, special districts, and assessors, we've come up with a proposal that allows for local negotiation and determination of the disposition of that community service fee. So that's built into the bill. So I'm going to touch on the strategic investment components of this sheet on page 1, and basically I've covered that base. There are a couple of important pieces. One, we're proposing to tailor the threshold and scale these projects for rural areas. And that's the nature of the -5 amendment. So I think I'll call time out on my comments right now and suggest that Representative Huck explain the -5 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As I believe you all have the -5 amendment in front of you. Because this section intentionally is trying to provide an additional option for local governments to create economic development in areas that are rural, one of the challenges of that is if you look at all areas that have been recently added to urban growth boundary expansions, they tend to be very rural areas. They tend to be on the far outskirts of urban areas. And yet, by the current definition of rural area, once they're in the UGB, instantaneously they would count as non-rural and therefore would not be eligible for the rural designation, and the local governments in those areas would not have the opportunity to use the Strategic Investment Program tool as a means of attracting business growth to those areas. Each of these areas obviously is in great demand of both housing and jobs. And I mean, there are a whole variety of areas in Clackamas County that are key examples of this, where you're bringing in large areas which are extremely rural and need both business and jobs in addition to homes to be able to operate effectively. So although the current statute would restrict the use of the Strategic Investment Program in these areas and would not allow it once they're inside the UGB, this -5 amendment would allow these areas to qualify for use of the Strategic Investment Program as long as they were rural, therefore outside the urban growth boundary, as of December 1st of 2002. So the most recent, in the Portland metropolitan area, the most recent expansion, which incorporated in a whole wide set of areas, would not, it would be the designation would be prior to that time period. You will notice that if you look back at the trade and economic development testimony, we did not have an opportunity to have this printed in time for consideration by our committee. We raised it at that point. There seemed to be support for it. I believe the department is fine with this amendment as it is. It's really trying to make sure areas that function as rural areas, that look like rural areas, but merely by their inclusion in the UGB with the latest expansion, are continue to be treated like rural areas for the purposes just of the strategic investment program.
Questions about the dash fives? What's the 30,000 or more? Who's that?
Mr. Chair, that's actually a provision that is taken out of another section of existing statute. So the 30,000 is not actually a change. That just in keeping with the current definition of rural areas, because that means it applies not just to the Portland metropolitan area, but to cities statewide. So the only substantive change of this is the last several words, as the urban growth boundary is acknowledged on December 1st, 2002.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, we're going to have
that. Thank you. I, Representative Hunt and Berger and I are very familiar with this bill, and I think this amendment is a good add. If you go through the areas that this amendment talks about, you're talking about farm, rural area. I mean, it feels very rural, even though it may have been amended to the UGB.
Is this a date we'll want to keep tabs on and change from time to time, though? I would imagine in 20 years those areas might look and feel a little bit different than they did on December 1 of 2002, and they may not seem so rural.
Good point, Mr. Chair, and I would anticipate that Mr. Burton will appear before you many, many, many times between now and then.
We don't need to put a sunset on this date.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, I heard two questions, and the second one, the answer is yes, we'll be back to you next time talking about this particular date, I'm sure. The other one is who's 30,000 more? That's essentially Corvallis, Albany, Bend, Klamath Falls, and then the big cities that we're all familiar with, Portland, Salem, Eugene, Medford. So it's a small set, but it's already a definition that's in our statute related to rural and urban.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions for Representative Hunt? All right. Then we will imagine.
Mr. Chair, could we say latest? That's under definition.
Oh, I don't know. Can we say latest? I think the department will probably keep tabs on this on a biennium basis, and we can just count on them to bring us up to date with any changes periodically. I imagine a date certain gives everyone a little bit greater. Well,
Chair Smith, members of the committee, if I could, one of the fixes we saw in 2298, the Small Cities Investment Bill, was to give jurisdictions a period of time in which to use these incentives to create this rural threshold and then not make it available to places which, as Representative Hunt has suggested, Representative Haas, are by all definitions rural except for this one, kind of seems to be almost cruel. And that's the point of this amendment, is to make sure that those places which are rural, have been rural, and only because of a recent change in the metro boundary, are urban, would be able to benefit from this change. In the future, I'm not sure that it matters that much, because the rural incentive will then have been in place.
Right.
So my thought is that you'll hear from us one time on this, which will be 2 years hence.
All right. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Back to you.
Chair Smith, members of the committee. Chair Smith, yeah. Sorry about that. Shetterly.
For Smith on this committee.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well.
Is that kind of the dummy script that's on the table down there?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair,
there's no name on this.
How much time our committee spent.
Oh.
it's a shorter word. I did not refer to you to the section. I touched on the high points of policy changes and strategic investment. I didn't refer you to those sections. If you'd like to spend a moment, I can point you to those. And we can go back and you can read
that's
through
right.
them. Okay. The other one that's important in terms of strategic investment is currently electrical generating facilities are not permitted within the strategic investment program. There's an explicit preclusion in the statute. This bill would remove that. And all of a sudden, with the rural threshold and inclusion of electrical generating facilities, I think you have a tool to address the problem you were just hearing about, or potentially another tool. Moving on to enterprise zones. As I discussed, the enterprise zone statute is very complicated. I wouldn't even refer you back to the current statute because it's so hard to find anything in that. The bill is so much better. I can't tell you how much better it is to have things organized in this way. And like I said, most of the changes are about that. There are, however, a few substantive changes in the enterprise zone statute. One of them is fairly minor, but currently an enterprise zone must apply all exemptions uniformly across the zone. We have proposed that specific to hotels, motels, and destination resorts that in the future zones be allowed to, within a zone, by jurisdiction, determine whether or not to allow an incentive for that kind of development. This is an issue right now in Lincoln County where Lincoln City does not want to incent hotel-motel development, but the existing zone, which is Newport, Depot Bay, and Waltport, or Newport, Waltport, and Toledo, does allow for that incentive. So it's one of the drivers of Representative Brown's bill to increase the number of zones. But we believe that there's a fix here that could help address that issue in terms of allowing that segregation. Another fairly significant change, and one of the intentions of the bill that derived out of our process with our customers, is in sections 33, 33A, and 39. But it's a, if you will, a productivity incentive for businesses that don't intend to create employment, which is otherwise a condition of enterprise zone exemptions. Well, let me talk about what enterprise zones are first. I'm moving ahead to the bill without really explaining to you what an enterprise zone does. I should back up and cover that base. An enterprise zone allows for a three-year exemption of property taxes in distressed parts of the state as defined in statute. This statute, there's a set of criteria for eligibility for enterprise zones. There are 47 zones available in the state, plus a couple of tribal zones, one of which has been designated, one has not yet applied. And there is an enterprise community in Josephine County, which is a federal designation, and the statute allows for that federally designated area to be part of be an enterprise zone. So essentially, there's a potential for 50 enterprise zones in Oregon. There are limitations on the size of a zone. There are limitations on the distances across the zone. But essentially, a sponsor, which is a city, a county, or a group of cities and counties, can identify areas where they're willing to incent development, and upon designation by the department after a competitive application process by zone sponsors, businesses that are qualified uses, which are essentially industrial or wholesale distribution, and these hotel, motel, destination resorts on assumption or upon designation by the zone, upon application can get a three-year exemption on their property taxes. That's all property taxes on new qualified investments. So in the context of these energy-generating facilities, the ones in Gillum County are exempted for 3 years on their investment and won't pay any property taxes for the first 3 years. If the firm pays exceptionally well, 150% of average county wages, it can negotiate with the zone sponsors a fourth and or fifth year exemption. These exemptions apply to all new investments of qualified businesses, not all, but essentially real property other than land and capital equipment. But the exemptions apply to those classes of assets, and essentially if you qualify, you get the 3 to 5, and apply, you get the three-year exemption. If you pay well and apply and negotiate an agreement, you get fourth and fifth years. And then there's a classification available in certain severely distressed rural areas, which allows for an exceptional exemption that can go from 7 to 15 years. That one is the only one that has an element of property tax or income tax exemption that goes along with it. So what we're talking about here are these enterprise zones where to incent investment in capital improvements in distressed parts of the state, local governments and taxing entities are willing to waive property taxes for a period of time. Then, as you heard, you reach a point where the investor starts paying taxes, and as far as I'm concerned, we're on our way at that point. So that's what it's about. Should I spend any more time talking about what the enterprise zone program is?
No, fine. We've heard about enterprise zones before.
Okay. All right, so now getting back to what the bill does.
Can you tell us about urban renewal?
No, I can't. There are people behind me. Chair Smith, Chair Satterley, members of the committee. We'll get back to what the bill does relative to the enterprise zone. What I was talking about before I did my little digression was that for the first time there would be an exemption for firms that don't intend to increase employment. Existing firms must either make huge investments or increase their employment by 10%. In the Portland area specifically, there have been a number of firms that have been willing to make investments, willing to increase their taxable assets, and do so in order to stay competitive in the market. They're going to be more productive. Their people are going to be more efficient, but they don't expect to create jobs. This bill would allow for an incentive for Oregon businesses that are willing to invest in order to stay competitive in the global market. I'm going to turn over to page 2. There are a set of the only really controversial items in this related to construction period exemptions. Under Oregon law, many businesses are allowed to not pay taxes while they're building their plant. They're not productive assets yet. They're not generating income off of them yet, so they're not taxed. There are some exceptions. They have to do with small-scale commercial development, and then to the point of the discussion we heard a little while ago, centrally assessed or essentially utility investments. In the past, those were not exempted on the construction in progress, but essentially they passed along their taxes to their ratepayers, their consumers, and it really didn't matter. It was a regulated industry, didn't really matter. That environment has changed, and as you heard from the electrical generators, it's a competitive market. They're essentially merchant producers now. They're manufacturing something, in this case electricity, and it matters to them ultimately what the capitalized base of payments is. So if they can get an exemption during the construction period when they're not constructive, it can provide an incentive to go ahead and make those investments. The bill proposes that be allowed in enterprise zones, not in all facilities, but would treat centrally assessed investments in an enterprise zone the same as any other investments in an enterprise zone. So if you're qualified for a zone, you would also be qualified for the construction in progress. I'll move along. I think that's good enough on that. The rest of the changes in the enterprise zone program per se are fairly straightforward, mostly just shifting things around. Finally, there is, I mentioned, the long-term rural exemption. There's one piece of housekeeping in this that I want to mention. This is the only place in any of these business tax incentives where existing property on which taxes are being paid is exempted. We believe that was an oversight. We believe that it's always been the intent of all of these programs to not take anything off the rolls, but to incent new investment. So we're cleaning up this part of the long-term rural exemption and saying that, for instance, land, which has been there forever, is not part of a new investment, is always subject to taxation and wouldn't be exempted. There was, at the end of the last session, there was a creation of a scaled version of, or improvements of scaled versions of long-term rural. This was kind of a precursor to the rural strategic investment program that we're proposing, but the idea is that in this case, if you're disadvantaged by being isolated a long ways from a freeway, you should get a special exemption. At the last minute, there was a cap on these long-term exemptions of $25 million, which had the perverse effect of putting a higher rate on the isolated communities than on those that were close to the interstate. So we're proposing here to change that, and while those proximate to interstates would be capped at $25 million, these will be capped, those remote investments would be capped at $12.5 million. And then the last substantive intention of the department's bill was to extend the sunset on the rural long-term rural exemption. That exemption's only been used once. We think that's largely because in a down economy, there's a lot of risk in investing very large amounts in very rural places. So we're proposing that we extend the sunset a couple more years and give people a chance to try it out, hopefully with the economy on the rebound.
Okay.
So in a nutshell, that's what's before you.
All right. That's why I say we will. Okay. I'll leave these. We'll keep these materials for a couple days' time to have a chance to look at them in detail, and then rely on our experts from the committee that's already heard this too to give us the high sign. Representative Berger.
If I could make just a quick comment, the front sheet that he handed out, I call this the Berger treat sheet.
Yeah,
I was meeting, I got pretty tired of this bill in committee, frankly, and finally said, just point a finger at the major policy significant sections of this bill. Otherwise, I'm getting lost, and I found this very helpful. You may or may not, but this policy, it's the only way I could get through it.
Okay, let's hear about the A6s. This will be new, Representative Berger.
So. You're right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
if you want to move that microphone over to you there, that's okay. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Pascone. I'm president of the Albany-Millersburg Economic Development Corporation. Representative Close, who was going to try to be here to support my amendment.
You're on your own. I got to know.
I'm on my own.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much. I'd like to give you a little history into my amendment and why I think we need it. I've had some help with some language, and it's in the back there from legislative counsel and from Art Fish of the department. And so we've got a little work on amending the language to the amendment, but I'd like to tell you about the history and why I feel we need it. We have a company in Albany called Pacific Cast Technologies. They've been in the area for probably 25 or 30 years, and they make titanium castings. In the year 2000, they were pre-certified in the enterprise zone to make an investment. The original investment was going to be about almost $9 million. Their pre-certified employment average was 240 employees. In years 2000 and 2001, they made their investment. It's almost $11 million. They completed the project in 2002. And enterprise zone regulations say that they must file an application for exemption by April 1st of the year after they complete the project. So this company in due course completed their project and invested the money. And then they were hit with a down economy and 9/11 and the subsequent recession. So their pre-certified average employment of 240 went down to about 211 or 212, and so the application for exemption that were they were supposed to file by April 1st does not allow them to have any tax exemption. So if you invest your money and you don't make the required level of employment that you're supposed to make, you lose the exemption. But the rules say that if you don't make your first year of exemption, you don't get any year. So this company, in good faith, made their investment. They were hoping to almost double their production capacity. And because they can't make their employment numbers in the first year, by the way, this year they're already hiring people, so they hope in subsequent years to be there. This company also qualified for the extended benefits because they pay very high wages. And so this precludes them from year one and 2, 3, 4, 5. So the glitch, I believe, in the rules locks them out of any incentive, and yet they, in good faith, invested the money and wanted to hire people. They were pretty happy about the fact that they were making their investment and going to expand their workforce. So what I would like to see is an amendment to the enterprise zone to allow companies to somehow look at each year at a time. If they don't make the first year, it doesn't preclude them for coming back, whereas a company that makes their first year numbers and doesn't make the second years can actually come back for the subsequent year. So we're sort of penalizing these companies because of the economy and the recession to, you're out the first time and they can't come back. So I think we're doing a disservice to our businesses that in good faith have made their investment, had every intention of increasing their employment, but because of the economy, they can't make the first-year numbers. Therefore, they're locked out from any future incentive. In the year that they don't make numbers, they're paying taxes, and that's as it should be. But I believe they shouldn't be precluded from subsequent years. Okay. And that's the substance of my amendment.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, conceptually, the department is in agreement with Mr. Pascone and actually pursued a change. I can't remember his last session or the one before that, but to address the situation for companies that had already qualified and fell from grace by essentially dropped below the employment standard. Change the law so that instead of losing all of the benefits, they only lost the benefits for those years that where they were not meeting the requirements. Mm-hmm. And we really don't have an issue with that in terms of the first year for the reason Mr. Pascone cited. He does propose that the department would pass judgment on whether this would happen. The amendment does. We'd rather not see that. We'd rather mechanically, in terms of how this works programmatically, if it's your policy decision that it should be on a year-to-year basis, that's fine. We'd like the zone sponsors who are responsible for this now on all other firms continue to be and certify that in the subsequent years for which tax exemptions will be granted, the company did meet its conditions of exemption.
Is that the way it works for companies that are in and then drop out and get back in? I mean, it's that same kind of...
Yes, okay, the department doesn't have to pass judgment on it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, point of explanation. That language was written by legislative counsel.
Oh, we know how that happened.
And Art Fish actually gave me some proposed language that would put it back on the sponsors, okay, which I think is where it should be.
All right. Does anybody have any problems with that? It seems fair. So what we're basically doing then is saying we're applying the same rules for that currently apply to a company that gets qualified and then fails to meet in the second or third year. Applying that same standard to a company that applies, makes the investment, but then for some reason fails to meet their first year, it allows them to at least stay eligible for a later year if they're able to bring their employment requirement.
Essentially, then certification becomes a year-by-year event.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Vance.
Thank you. I was just wondering, is this similar to the problem that Simcoe Wafer has here? I know there's another bill where they're trying to get through because they, due to the economy, have fallen.
Yeah, it's not unlike. It's a I mentioned in my testimony that there is an exemption for very large investments, and I'm not sure which category. Simco made very large investments. I'm not sure which category they fall under, but there is an exception there already. Again, there's already a way to get at this for certain other investments, but this is the same kind of thing. And while this is a different fix for a different problem, it's related.
But this raises the issue, Mr. Chair, that in a down economy, you do have these falling employment numbers, you know, best laid intentions and all that. But I suppose you also have to guard against companies that can make higher than realistic claims of employment in order to just qualify. And so somewhere there's got to be.
Except an existing firm would not be able to qualify. We're not moving the threshold on qualification. We're just saying that you don't have to do it every year. I mean, you don't have to. You don't have to do it the first year, and you can as long as you're willing to not to forego an exemption in a given year, then it's okay to cycle through normal business decisions.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, I've been an enterprise zone manager for about 7 years, and the companies that prepare these pre-certifications really do a conscientious job of trying to do projections, trying to make sure they can make the numbers. I mean, most companies I know like to make the investment knowing that they can increase business and increase employment. And so these companies I see do a fairly conscientious job of trying to project the numbers. And so,
and bottom line is if they don't make the projections, they don't get the benefit.
Exactly, yeah. It just seems a shame that this company was looking forward to 5 years of enterprise zones, locked out the first year, and then forever. And that's
would it be your intention that these amendments be retroactive to pick up this particular?
Yeah, we've got some dates and some of the language that would cover a period of time during the recession.
Representative Barnard?
Well, and of course, Mr. Chair, from our point of view, it seems to me that
if we accept this idea of enterprise zones and all and these incentives in the first place, then we'd want to make them as transparent as possible so that future businesses coming along won't say, well, they're going to zap us if we don't make it the first year.
Good point. Okay, now how hard will it be to get those amendments in ready to move form? Do you know? I mean, is it conceptually, is it difficult to do?
I don't think so.
If we leave this on for Wednesday, is there a chance we could have the amendments? Yeah. Do you think? Okay, we'll leave you to try. Let's try and do that. If you are running into trouble, let our staff know, and we can reschedule this for maybe later in the week. But I'd like to get this out if we can on Wednesday, then, and we'll look at those new amendments.
Thank you very
much. Any other questions for either Mr. Burton or Mr. Stone? Thank you. Moving forward. Yes, Representative Farr.
Approximately 2 hours ago, you suggested that we may have a potentially short meeting.
Yeah, we'll see. We're going to end up 10 minutes short of our time. That's what I meant. Well, I'm sorry we got so long-winded on that first one.
I apologize, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Anybody else want to talk to us while we're still in session? All right. Thank you. Then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2299. And with that,
you.